In the past 10 years, diversity, equity, and inclusion as a social concept has risen to the highest levels of institutionalization under the Obama and Biden administrations, as well as in higher education and corporate settings. It has been seen as a crucial corrective to the long history of institutional racism that has plagued our country from even before its founding. DEI has also been raised up by political and cultural conservatives as the central target of their efforts to wage a cultural war against liberal wokeness in order to preserve the traditional history and culture of the United States. Understanding what constitutes diversity and inclusion seems fairly straightforward, but what about equity? In this episode of the Future of the Past Lab, we talk with Dr. Charles McNamara from the University of Minnesota, whose new book, Learning to Be Fair, explores the concept of equity from classical philosophy to contemporary politics. We discover the surprising fluidity of this concept through the ages and how key figures in our country's history grappled with the legal and cultural weight of equity long before it became a buzzword in our contemporary culture wars. Hi, I'm your host, Steve Ahern Kroll, and this is the Future of the Past Lab, the podcast where we rethink the legacies of injustice and the study of antiquity. So we're here today with Dr. Charles McNamara at the University of Minnesota. He is the director of Greek and Latin and here to talk to us about his new book, Learning to Be Fair, Equity from Classical Philosophy to Contemporary Politics. So welcome, Charlie.
Thanks, Steve. Happy to be here.
Yeah. So why did you decide to write this book in the first place?
So I'm a classicist by training, and I'm always interested in words and concepts, their histories, how they have gotten from antiquity, oftentimes into our own contemporary language and thought. But more particularly with this book, and I think the reason why I focused on this word in particular, is I was really struck just talking to friends, family, just people in the broader culture about this notion of equity. And my impression, just talking to people, was that there was this pretty widespread misunderstanding that equity was something that was novel, radical, revolutionary even. That is to say, something that had been invented in relatively recent history. And just as a student of classical antiquity, I understood that that was not the case, and that this notion of equity, both in the Greek and in the Latin tradition, has a really long history. And so I was first attracted to this idea of writing an essay, and not even a book yet, but initially an essay about this notion of equity, really just to provide a kind of corrective for the way that people understood this notion of equity, where it came from, how we came to talk about it. Because again, I was really, just struck by the almost ubiquity of how people thought of equity as something that had been sort of cooked up 25 years ago, and not as I see it, especially in the book, really starting with Aristotle and the Nicomachean Ethics.
Yeah, I mean, later, you know, in the later part of the book, you talk about Florida's decision to ban thinking, basically, beyond very strict guidelines about U.S. history and culture. And it seems like a setting like that would have benefited from having something like your book to flesh out, you know, well, maybe this isn't such a radical, strange new notion of how to think about the world. And so I want to explore a little bit more about the historical process you went through, because, you know, there's a couple of things that I've noticed in our culture. One is that there's a combination of a fascination with origins of things, while at the same time, a fascination with not looking back at history. So how did your work on this book kind of reconcile those two poles of thinking?
So the concept of equity, I think, is a really good concept for exploring the problem that you're looking at here, because even if there is this really rich, long, complicated history behind this idea, it is not a history that has one dimension, one answer, one kind of simplistic notion behind it. And in fact, to get to the point that you were talking about earlier in how various legislative entities have tried to regulate or to kind of narrow the way that we can talk about equity, in the same way that it's really difficult to narrow or simplify the way that we talk about freedom or citizenship or personhood. I mean, these are just incredibly difficult concepts that are always going to be contentious. I think that equity falls into that same bucket of what I call in the book and what other people also call an essentially contested concept. So to get to your question again, you know, on the one hand, I think it's important to look at the history of a word and a concept to show how it's not something that's radically new, that a notion like equity really brings to the fore some durable perennial problems that we always need to be thinking about regarding identity, regarding equality, regarding citizenship. While at the same time, drawing out from that history that there is not a kind of single answer or kind of solution to how we should think about equity, that like, if only people would like go and read Aristotle, Nicomachean Ethics, Book 5, like they would finally understand what equity is supposed to be. I don't think that these histories provide us a simple answer. What I do think they do, and what I really try to do in the book, is to anchor the questions and anchor the problems that a concept like equity introduces for us, to make sure that when we are talking about those problems and those questions and those durable, productive disagreements, that we can talk about them in ways that are, let's say, a little bit more sort of substantive and grounded.
Yeah, and complex. So I don't know if you run into this in your classes, but when I teach my biblical studies classes, there are terms that people take for granted as if they're A, self-explanatory, and B, very stable in their meaning. I mean, a great one in my context is the word faith when we're talking about Paul's epistles. And when I talk about it in class, I talk about it in ways that are as complex as possible so that they can get that out of their heads. It seems like what you're doing here is kind of similar to that, but also trying to complexify the relationship between the present and the past without dismissing it altogether. And so I was wondering if you could,
Do, or? I think that the upshot of grounding this in the past is that specific to equity, we get a kind of conflicting history of this word, specifically in two traditions as I draw it out in the book. On the one hand, I think that there's this really strong Aristotelian tradition of thinking about equity as a principle that allows us to make exceptions to rules, that we have a kind of norm that we're trying to apply to all members of a group, and that this notion of equity that Aristotle really formulates in the Ethics, he explains why we would want to break out of those norms, why we might want to not apply a rule equally to everyone. On the other hand, there's a tradition of equity that I think really comes out of the Latin tradition, and this is where we get our kind of etymological link to the Latin tradition, where in Latin we have the word aequitas, which is, of course, where we get the word equity today in English. And the notion of aequitas really is etymologically linked to this notion of equal, that is to say, flat, that is to say, unbending. And just thinking about, again, like those two historical traditions that we're dealing with, and again, getting back to your original question about the role of history and genealogy and origins here, is that we get two traditions and origins of this concept that are actually fundamentally incompatible. That on the one hand, Aristotle is sketching a notion of equity for us that explains why we would want not to apply a rule equally to everyone, and in fact, why the just, correct, ethical thing to do is to apply a rule to everyone else except this one exceptional case. Whereas, again, in the Latin tradition, with this notion of aequitas, again, really leaning into that etymological notion of equal, that equity there is going to strive for this notion of equal treatment to all people, and that we would want to correct any exceptional, that is to say, erroneous, that is to say, aberrant treatment of someone who's not getting the same fair treatment as everyone else. So again, we get this sort of really interesting history that does not provide for us the answer or a answer even of how we should think about equity, but instead introduces for us this really kind of intractable problem where we have two equally august Greco-Roman traditions of how to understand this word and this notion of fairness that really do just run directly contrary to one another. So how do we negotiate that kind of contradiction? How do we negotiate that kind of paradox? And I think that paradox, in fact, is what I found so fascinating about thinking about this concept. Because again, I did not write this book where you get to the last page and you say, aha, finally, like I know what equity is, like problem solved.
And I was really disappointed by that.
Yeah, I'm really sorry. Sorry to all the readers out there. But that you do get to the last page and you say, well, okay, you know, now I have a more anchored understanding of how people have tried to grapple with that paradox for literally 2,500 years. Mm-hmm. So welcome to the club, readers.
Yeah, exactly. So I know there's, you had limited space in this book to explore some of these things, but in other contexts other than the modern context, especially ancient Greece and Rome for now, how did this play out in terms of, you know, those two poles that you were talking about? How did it play out in terms of the practical everyday implications of, say, like Plato's ideas of this very rigid kind of system versus Aristotle's? Was it merely philosophy, or did it actually sort of get into everyday culture in any concrete way that you could find, or how did that work out?
Yeah, so I think maybe just a little bit of background in terms of the real world applicability of this question, or the real world applicability just of equity, broadly speaking. The tension or the difference that you're gesturing toward here between Plato and Aristotle, I think really does get at the kind of fundamental reason why Aristotle is interested in this notion of equity in the first place. So just a little bit of background here. Plato, when he talks about the forms, let's say in book 6 and 7 in the Republic, Plato is really interested in this idea of ethical principles that in some way mirror or are analogous to mathematical principles, that they are steady, that they are not really constructed by us. They are in some way or another kind of transcendental. That is to say, like they're pretty firm and not contingent on what we do to them. They merely exist. And so Plato, again, is going to have this notion of justice, of a justice that's kind of capital J justice out there. In the Ethics, Aristotle really pushes back against that. And Aristotle is really committed to this idea of justice, not with a capital J as a form, but justice, and this is kind of his terminology, justice relative to the person. And so Aristotle is interested not simply in what is the concept of justice as it exists universally as a principle, but rather how people can be treated justly. Now, the reason why I wanted to give all of that background information is because, of course, Aristotle is going to think most particularly about that in the concept of the law courts, not thinking about justice as a concept, but really justice as something that we enact or that we have to grapple with in real world, scare quotes around real world, legal proceedings. And so to get to the question again, you know, like how does this kind of operate in sort of day-to-day workings of the ancient world? I mean, it really does begin with Aristotle thinking about this as particularly a legal problem. If we have a law that is written in such and such way, it's great that we have the rule of law and we need to apply these laws when they come up in legal cases. But once we find a party in a court case who is somehow unexpected or in some way doesn't quite line up with the way that this law is written, under what conditions, to what degree, should we bend these rules in the name of the Greek word epieikeia, which is what becomes the word equitas, which is what becomes the word equity? Should we, in that real physical legal circumstance, should we think of justice as something that is bendable, contingent, malleable around what I call this sort of equity of the exception? So, yeah, I mean, you know, like what is the the real world applicability of it, primarily, at least for Aristotle, in the law courts.
Yeah. But then when you fast forward to the early moments of our country, you really see it in your discussion of Alexander Hamilton and construction of a justice system and what that all means, and even an economic system and what that all means.
Yeah, one of the things that I actually thought was really interesting, and you know, I'm certainly not an American historian. Primarily, I work in Greco-Roman intellectual history, and I was really fascinated to look at this period between basically the Declaration of Independence and the ratification of the Constitution, where, understandably, the early Americans were really hesitant to empower sort of judicial authorities to decide what is fair, to decide what is reasonable, coming back to this kind of application to the law courts, and that these early American political thinkers, that they were really invested in this idea of consent of the governed. And so it kind of makes sense that they would be hesitant to empower some fancy judge to decide what is fair and what is not fair, and when the law applies and when it doesn't apply, and when we can bend around an exceptional case and when we cannot bend around an exceptional case. And so as I talk about in the third chapter of this book, the early Americans, kind of in the eve of the ratification of the U.S. Constitution, they really try to write their statutes in a way that Aristotle warned is a way that you can't really do this, where you try to have immensely complex legislation that really does enumerate every single case where a law can and cannot apply. And as these early Americans realize, is that the complexity of the law is just totally unmanageable. It invites all kinds of corruption because you end up having to sort of skirt around this or that application of the law. And so almost begrudgingly, as we see in, for example, Anti-Federalist 11, where people are warning against, you know, empowering judges to interpret the law, my goodness, that the Americans kind of begrudgingly give up on this project. And they say, oh, you know, we tried to have a system of statutory law where we would not ever have to bend the law. We would not ever have to interpret the law, and that we could somehow explicitly enumerate every single case where this law would apply. And after trying that and seeing how difficult and, in fact, impossible it was, they then decided that, okay, we need to empower judges to act with the principle of equity and legal interpretation, which is why that word, as Alexander Hamilton talks about in Federalist 80, which is why that word comes up in Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution.
Yeah. In some ways, it seems like they actually didn't listen, you know, not just to Aristotle, but the later Americans didn't listen to that failed effort, because I was just listening on the car ride over here that I forget what the story was, but there was a mention of executive orders, and they were naming the executive order by the number of the executive order, and it was something in the 30,000s. It's like, that's just executive orders.
Sure.
That's not all the laws that exist in our country. And it seems like there's this, you know, every time a new case comes up or a new situation comes up in our country, they you know, there's another law that addresses that. And it makes a judge's job almost impossible to know all of that, all of the law, to
let alone citizens.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
So. No, exactly. And I think, you know, one of the really interesting paradoxes and problems that Aristotle raises here is, you know, how we are expected to understand our knowledge of the law and of justice and of fairness and of reasonableness. And this maybe gets a little bit back to this contrast that we have in chapter one here, of the book, between Plato and Aristotle. Plato, again, thinking to something like the middle books of the Republic, Plato's really committed to this idea of a sort of rational, conceptual notion of justice, almost analogous, again, to understanding math proofs, that it's something that we could really intellectually grasp. Aristotle really pushes back against that intellectualized notion of justice, and especially in the Ethics. Aristotle doesn't want us to think of justice as almost like the periodic table, where we would have to just memorize this unbelievable, massive corpus of knowledge, and that that is what it means to understand justice and fairness and, you know, so on and so forth. But instead, Aristotle wants us to sort of cultivate this ethical disposition. This is, I think, the language that he would want us to use, where it's not so much that we have to memorize 30,000 executive orders or whatever other kind of hilarious body of text. And like, that's what it means to understand justice. But that instead that we would become the kind of character who would know how to judge things in the right way at the right time with the right person.
Yeah. I mean, you raised the question that of the relationship between law and ethics or law and morality. Mm-hmm. And I have to confess that I was a little bit intrigued, or maybe more than a little bit intrigued, by Isocrates' take on all of this, because I think his motivation of glory or fame or whatever is not something I would ascribe to, but the idea of a sort of practical end to this was very interesting and appealing to me. So I was wondering if you could talk about that a bit more.
Sure. So I think maybe before we talk about Isocrates, one of the really key distinctions, and this is something that I have encountered with conversations with people who are really full-blown in philosophy. Again, I think of myself more as a classicist and not really a full-blown philosopher. But this distinction that Aristotle is going to present for us, this distinction between ethics on the one hand and morality on the other hand. A little bit getting to what I was saying about Aristotle versus Plato, and we can extend this, I think, to Aristotle versus, let's say, the Stoics, or Aristotle versus, let's say, Kant. Aristotle wants us to think of ethics not just as following a rule. So in the way that we might think of the Ten Commandments or a kind of Kantian categorical imperative, Aristotle doesn't think of behaving well as not transgressing such and such moral law, mm-hmm. thou shalt not steal, so on and so forth. But instead, what Aristotle wants us to think about is, rather than a moral law that we can't transgress, that we have the ethical, that is to say, character, disposition to do as the good person would do. And this is how he talks about this in Book 2, Chapter 4 of the Ethics, that it's not so much that we do the right thing, but that we behave in the way that the good person would behave. So what Aristotle wants us to cultivate here is not an obedience to a moral law, but he wants us to cultivate a kind of way of living. Now, to get to your question about Isocrates, in the last chapter of the book, Isocrates, who is roughly, let's say, a contemporary of Plato and Aristotle, Isocrates also, interestingly, uses this notion of epieikeia, which is what becomes our word, aequitas, equity, which is to say, Isocrates is also very interested in the notion of fairness or reasonableness, or I think maybe another good translation of the word, especially for Isocrates, is something like seemliness, that things kind of have the appearance of being fine. When Isocrates talks about things being reasonable or abiding by a notion of seemliness, we have to ask, well, reasonable to whom? Or sort of appropriately seemly according to whose rubrics and criteria? Now, Isocrates, at least in my reading, Isocrates really defaults to or has this almost unquestioning comfort with the notion of reasonableness or seemliness or appropriateness that is just the kind of governing norms and attitudes of his society. That is to say, Isocrates is really not Socrates. Socrates, who is very happy to be the gadfly, to question, to prod, to make people uncomfortable. Isocrates thinks of things being appropriate and seemly if they don't ruffle any feathers.
Yeah.
And so this really raises this question, getting back even to this original idea about equity as the principle of knowing when to bend the rules, for whom to bend the rules, under what circumstances to bend the rules. A lot of people will look at that and say, well, this is really just a kind of fancy window dressing for allowing people to not have rules apply to them when they have the power to not abide by the rules. And my reading of Isocrates in the way that he thinks about reasonableness and fairness is that Isocrates is pretty close to that idea that we should be reasonable in the way that things are going today. Other people have tried to position this notion of epieikeia or equity not as a kind of excuse to continue established practice, which again is how I roughly read Isocrates, but instead that you could use equity to, let's say, really challenge the status quo or to change how society has already established its own norms.
Yeah, it's a really sticky situation when you get to that point of like who is determining what's good and fair. And then how do you, you know, if things are relative to the good person or you want to do things that are helpful or good or whatever, you know, who determines what that is? And that is, as we're seeing played out in this country, a very difficult thing to navigate for sure.
Well, but I mean, and this really gets back to that original political situation that you brought up earlier of the early Americans.
Yeah.
I think it's understandable for people to be reluctant to empower some uniquely intelligent, prudential judge who's going to make all of these, you know, difficult ethical decisions for the benefit of everyone else, of course. And so this skepticism, or this maybe, again, kind of reluctance among the early Americans to empower someone to do that and to almost like cast off their own ability to do that, at least in the context of the state. No, that makes sense. I try not to read Aristotle, and some people certainly do, and so this is not like authoritative at all, but like I try not to read Aristotle as just a guidebook for the ruling class. It is definitely possible to do that, and that Aristotle is just giving kind of, you know, tips on how to manage the little people.
Right.
And this, I think maybe you especially see, you know, for example, notoriously in book one of Aristotle's Politics, where he's, you know, more or less giving the intellectual framework for natural mastery over natural slaves. But in any case, you know, I don't want to read his discussion of equity as a way for powerful people to justify their iron grip on the rule of law. And that instead, you know, it can really open some of these paradoxes and questions for us to think about. You know, when is it that rules begin to fail?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, thinking about our own context now a bit more, where, I mean, we find ourselves in a very polarized situation. And people think it's just politics sometimes, it's political polarization, but I don't think it's that. I think that's an outcropping of a real cultural divide where it seems like the certain people want rigid rules along the lines of what they want, and then other people want what they want. And then that idea of a judge adjudicating, or even not even a person of a judge, but just the process of coming together, even if you don't fully agree on things, that middle part has dropped out so much. And with a term like equity, it's just one of many kind of flashpoints. But I mean, first of all, would you agree with that sort of assessment? And then second of all, do you see a way through that polarization, that cultural polarization for us? Please give us an answer to that.
Well, I mean, I think maybe the first thing that I would say is that I don't actually think that bending the rules is always great. Mm-hmm. I do think that actually sometimes we need to be pretty firm on things applying equally to all people insofar as people belong to the same group. And this is the sort of second species, let's say, of equity that I talk about in the book. What I call in chapter 4, equity of the norm. That is to say, when all people belong to the same category of individuals, that in fact the exception is a miscarriage of justice, that unequal treatment is wrong because we should in fact be treating all people the same way, again, on account of the fact that they are members of the same group. So to come back to your question about kind of contemporary political life, one person, one vote. Do I think that there should be exceptions to our, you know, willingness to allow people to exercise their franchise? Not really. I mean, you know, it's going to be hard for me to, you know, be willing to bend the rules around someone being able to vote. So again, I don't want to give the impression, and I don't try to make this case in the book, that bending the rules is always necessarily a good idea. To your original question about political polarization, I certainly don't have like some silver bullet here about polarization and you know, how we can encourage people to be a little bit more flexible in their political beliefs, which is, I think, kind of the direction that you were going in. What I do think is really interesting, and this I touch on a little bit in chapters 4 and 5 in the book, is the way that we think of educating citizens and how we can encourage citizens to behave reasonably, fairly. These, of course, are all just synonyms and translations of equitably, justly. And one of the really big debates that emerges from Plato and Aristotle and really carries through, I think, quite beautifully in a lot of 20th century thinkers is whether we think of that process of civic education as this sort of Platonic intellectual project, or in a kind of different vein here, if this is a capacity of civic virtue that we cultivate, not with a particular body of knowledge that you can recite the three branches of the federal government, let's say, but that instead you cultivate a capacity to see people unlike you as members of the same group of citizens who all deserve the same right to vote, let's say, going back to that example of not making exceptions. So one of the thinkers that I bring up in chapters 4 and 5 is Richard Rorty. And I think that we could really dive into some other thinkers in this, let's say, broader history of American pragmatist philosophy. Mm-hmm. Another thinker who's doing really wonderful work right now is Daniel Allen, mm-hmm. Also in this vein, who again also comes up in book 5. But in any case, Rorty and Allen also, they talk about how civic education, democratic education, again, is not this Platonic intellectual examination of a body of knowledge, but that civic education happens when we read novels, when we watch documentaries, when we experience and redefine and refine and in some ways tweak, that is to say, construct and build and improve our notions of who other citizens are, what it looks like to be a citizen, what American lives can look like and should look like. And again, these kinds of civic virtues or notion of civic knowledge, that these are not really things that we can just study like the periodic table, mm-hmm. but that these really are a form of narrative education, which is how Richard Rorty talks about it. So to get to your question one more time about political polarization and how can we, in some ways, inspire people to see those who they disagree with as fellow Americans. As Daniel Allen sees it, and as I also, I think, see it, it really is a good argument for education in the humanities, that we don't just read novels to become better literary critics and analysts of language, but that we do also learn about how people live their lives to understand what human lives are like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what people have done to imagine a different way of living as well. You know, insight into the human condition is only one part of a novel, but it's also imagining, you know, a different kind of future perhaps, or an alternative future of some sort. Yeah, I was really fascinated with Daniel Allen's take on education, how it's a both and rather than an either or. Could you unpack that a little bit?
A little bit, yeah. So, and I think that this maybe also intersects quite well with the material on Isocrates. Isocrates, who again thinks of epieikeia, which is ultimately becomes this notion of equity, reasonableness, fairness, that in my reading of Isocrates, he really embraces reasonableness as these, let's say, norms that already exist in a society, which is to say, we're not pulling a move like Socrates, where we are trying to push against established notions, concepts, so on and so forth. Socrates as the gadfly. But Isocrates embracing some of those notions and concepts and current practices and norms. the way that Danielle Allen thinks about this, and she talks about education, again, in this almost kind of pragmatist way of thinking of narrative as building our capacity of civic virtue. She is very careful to empower not just, let's say, an educational establishment, but also to empower individual students who have their own ideas of, you know, their lives, their values, what they imagine to be important to them. Now, she is not, to be very clear here, Danielle Allen is not relinquishing the control of academics and educators to just allow students to have the steering wheel and to do whatever they want. But what she is saying is that to avoid the danger of merely reinforcing in this Isocratian way, merely reinforcing the norms and ideas that are already prevailing in a society, we should, in addition to, let's say, continuing to teach canonical texts, canonical authors, that we should also embrace kind of novel forms of narrative that individual students might bring to the table. Because, of course, students are novel and interesting themselves, and they bring ideas that, you know, we should be open to incorporating into our own worldviews.
Mm-hmm. So when you think about how she views education, and then you come to the Florida laws that were passed by Governor DeSantis, it just seems like such a knee-jerk reaction, an ignorant reaction to a clearly political situation. And this idea that you can't teach certain things because there's this inherent threat to the social order. I know why he was doing it, but it still is just so upsetting to think about what those students in Florida are going through now and the teachers in Florida are going through now, being so handcuffed, especially one, you know, huge group that is being targeted here, namely any person that doesn't fit into the white majority of this country. Now it's illegal for them to learn about it, about their history in school, because it has a catchphrase name to it, like critical race theory. So thinking about Danielle Allen's work in the midst of that, it's just her way, obviously, for me, is a much better way to go than Rick DeSantis's way.
Well, the reason why I brought up the Florida legislature is not to make an academic book into a political hit piece.
Sure.
Right? I am not a political pundit. I am not here like telling people to vote for this or that.
Right.
What, again, I try to do in the book is to explore equity as this paradoxical concept and as a concept that is inherently paradoxical.
Yeah.
Which is to say that it cannot be boiled down to a slogan or a catchphrase.
Yeah.
And in fact, I think the notion of equity, as Aristotle at least sees it, is entirely antithetical to that, because the whole idea of equity is that once we write something down, or once we kind of determine what, let's say, a law is supposed to do, we're going to come head on with exceptions and we have to completely reorient what we think about something. So in any case, I talked about the law in Florida, which tries to literally outlaw coursework on equity and other kinds of words that the Florida legislature doesn't seem to like.
Yeah.
As an example of people trying to make a paradoxical, difficult, complicated concept, make that into something that is reductive and simplistic.
Yeah.
The other examples that I provide in the conclusion of the book alongside equity include things like freedom. If we had a legislature somewhere in the U.S. that decided that it was illegal for coursework to talk about freedom, we would just laugh at how absurd that is.
Yeah.
Because, of course, freedom is such a contested idea. If we ask 50 people what freedom means, we're going to get at least 50 different answers.
Right.
And I think that equity falls into that same condition, where if the Florida legislature imagines that equity equals critical race theory, or that it equals equal outcomes, or that it equals something, what they have essentially done is they have shut down academic debate on a concept that is endlessly debatable and, in fact, has been debated for 2,500 years. So again, I didn't write the conclusion of the book to tell people in Florida to like vote this way or that.
Right.
I wrote the conclusion to highlight the absurdity and I think really the danger of allowing some powerful entity, in this case, a state legislature, to decide for us what a concept means.
Yeah.
In exactly the same way that I would be very upset if, you know, the Minnesota state legislature told me what I had to think citizenship meant.
Yeah.
I would not stand for that.
Yeah.
And I don't think that people should stand for a government saying what a word like equity can or cannot mean.
Yeah, and there's a huge disenfranchisement whenever you try to do something like that because you're choosing a side and you're choosing to single out a group for their perspective rather than, you know, trying to, like with a concept like equity, if you define it so clearly like the Florida legislature tried to do as you can only talk about it in these contexts, then there's a whole swath of people that are disenfranchised from learning about it in other contexts, in their contexts, for instance. So yeah, it's a very this is where I think I know your book is a great book, but it's not going to be a bestseller, unfortunately.
Well, Steve,
I hate to break it to you.
I hope we can look back on this interview and laugh one day.
But you know what you were getting at before about humanities education should be a bestseller. You know, it should be a kind of bottom line of who we are as Americans to learn as much as we can about the human condition that happens in humanities courses and a broad variety of humanities courses. And that plays out in every corner of the world. If you can do that well, no matter what you do for a living, it's going to matter.
No, and I think just to bring one last point into this, I think one of the other aspects of this Florida legislation that I found really frustrating and in fact self-refuting is that while on the one hand, it almost sort of outlaws discussions of equity or gender or these other kind of really complicated problems. I mean, you know, if you want to think about gender, my goodness, like go read Plato's Republic, book 5.
Right.
And it's just, like, there it is. I mean, it's really difficult and wonderful and fascinating material. But that on the one hand, this law tries to outlaw discussions of these kinds of concepts while at the same time requiring that students read the kind of great masterworks of Western political philosophy. And I'm like, well, okay, so what are we doing here, people? Because if we read the Nicomachean Ethics, which I would like to think is a kind of bedrock text of, you know, philosophical inquiry, we are going to, as soon as we get to Book 5, Chapter 10, we are going to have to discuss this concept of equity.
Yeah.
We are going to, when we teach Plato's Republic to our students, when we get to Book 5, we're going to have to talk about the notion of gender and sex and the equality of men and women and all of those kinds of terms. And so I would just like people to get their story straight, to like make up their minds. You know, are we going to discuss these kinds of topics and terms and questions and paradoxes, or are we not?
Yeah.
And this particular law, again, I just find completely self-refuting because on the one hand, it outlaws any discussion of those terms while in the next breath requiring the very authors and texts where those terms are absolutely central.
Yeah. I'm reminded of a recent law that was passed in, I think it was Texas, and I'm just looking it up. I don't have that off the top of my head, but I think it's in Texas that was passed. It was a book censoring law, censoring sexually explicit material to be in school libraries or being taught in schools. And they didn't think far enough ahead to what would be in that category.
Mm-hmm.
And the Bible actually falls in that category, which is just the opposite of what they wanted to have happen. So if you're going to exclude some things, you really have to, you know, and it just shows the interconnectedness of everything, you know, that there's not a set up subset of things that are pure. that you can legislate, and then the rest is garbage. And
no, of course. I mean, you know, to any students out there listening, you know, if you want to read some really filthy stuff, go read some Latin poetry.
Yeah,
my
right.
Goodness, I mean, that stuff is, ooh, my God.
Right. Well, thank you so much. This has been a great discussion. So in our previous episodes, we've ended, and I'll put this question to you as well, for any advice you would have for a young graduate student coming up in this world, for how to proceed in this very both politically and culturally fraught world, or the difficulties that graduate students will face in their futures as they go through their programs. So any sage advice from Dr. Charles McNamara to wrap up our discussion here?
One thing that I found really helpful as a graduate student for launching some of my own projects and just having opportunities to develop my own thinking was to do some public-facing writing. And writing in, let's say, literary magazines, you know, places where you can be thoughtful and sort of unabashedly intellectual, but with a little bit lower pressure than what you have if you're trying to publish an article in a top-flight scholarly journal. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the idea of this book originally came out of a article that I wrote in 2022 for Commonweal Magazine, where mm-hmm. I've written a number of book reviews and other kinds of essays. And I've been really grateful for the public-facing writing that I've done for Commonweal and elsewhere, because it has allowed me to really practice some of my writerly craft in a way that is, I think, much harder to do if the only writing that you're doing is academic journal writing, which, of course, has a much slower pace and is a little harder to do if you're thinking about reflections on contemporary culture.
Yeah.
So yeah, for graduate students out there, early career academics who are listening to this, I think finding some outlet for writing that extends a little bit beyond the narrow confines of strictly scholarly journal academic writing has just been immensely helpful for me. And I would encourage other people to do the same.
Yeah, that's great advice. And it also helps to, when you're doing that, it enables you to articulate your very scholarly ideas in non-technical language, which is very important for teaching. It's very important for talking to other humans.
And it's fun.
Yeah,
it is. I've had a really fun time writing for a kind of non-specialist audience, and you get great feedback.
Yeah.
So you know, again, it has just been such an important sort of stepping stone in my own academic career.
Great. Well, thanks so much for joining us today, and I wish you well, and hopefully there'll be a book next on justice or freedom or something like that I look forward to. So thank you so much.
Great. Thanks for having me on, Steve.
This has been a production of the Future of the Past Lab at the University of Minnesota's Department of Classical and Near Eastern Religions and Cultures. Our recording engineer is Jonathan Prestrud, at the College of Liberal Arts Language Center at the University of Minnesota. Visit futureofthepastlab.com to learn more about how we are rethinking the legacies of injustice in the study of antiquity.